This podcast is about inspiring people in audiology from different backgrounds and experiences. My name is Sidra, I'm a clinical scientist and I'm part of the BAA Early Professionals Committee. Today we have invited 2022's BAA Audiologist of the Year winner, Dr. Bhavisha Palmer, somebody that has definitely inspired me throughout my career, to talk about her journey in audiology from BSc all the way to PhD. So Bhavisha, if you just would like to introduce yourself a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you've already introduced me really nicely. I'm an audiologist. I'm in research, and I think now I've got quite a variety of roles, which is something that's definitely keeps me interested in our field, and it gets me meeting lots of different people. So totally happy to be here and talk to you today. So thanks for the invite.
Lovely, thank you. So can you tell us about your journey into the field of audiology and sort of what inspired you to initially pursue a career in audiology?
What inspired me to pursue a career in audiology? Well, I think my story of, early on in my decision making was quite similar to other people, in that I actually didn't know what audiology was. And I applied for medical school because I wanted to be a doctor. And I didn't do so well or as expected in my A-levels, and so fell into audiology. But I did choose audiology as a backup choice. Compared to other health professions, when I did speak to audiologists, I did a placement just to observe. I went and met lots of audiologists and went to lots of open days at that time. And something drew me towards audiology as a field, because it does connect that, the sciences, it being a health profession, you get to meet lots of people, you get to help people. And I think that is the similar story to lots of people who do audiology in the end, is that that is something that's very, very attractive about our field. So that is why I ended up in audiology.
Wow, that's lovely. And what would you say some of the significant milestones or turning points in your career that sort of shaped your path as an audiologist?
Yeah, there's been quite a few significant points. I did my degree at UCL Ear Institute and I graduated in 2012. And what was significant about that is meeting lots of people that's still in my life now, but also Sound Seekers, a charity, they had their main office within UCL Ear Institute's building. And so I'd always pop in and see them, and got to learn that their work was really interesting and they were developing audiology clinics in low resource settings. And so when I was doing my master's, I decided that I could, try and work with them. And there was a volunteer placement there. And so I went to Zambia after I finished my master's. I just went to Zambia and I got to really see the impact of trying to develop services there, but also mainly the challenges. So it really wasn't a place where you could just sort of rock up and do some hearing tests and give out some hearing aids. And that's not what I wanted to do anyway, but really to try and work with the Ministry of Health and really try and embed ear and hearing care services was obviously much more of a long-term goal than something that could be done in the short term. However, the skills I built in that experience definitely helped me. And one of the key things through that experience was I kept going to key stakeholders in Zambia, and they would say, well, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? Where's the research? And of course, there is really a lack of research in that area, but also research wasn't my thing. I didn't really know anything about research. I did a research project as part of my degree. I did a research project as part of my master's. It was super interesting, but I didn't really see potentially how it could influence change and impact change. So while I was in Zambia, all of those conversations about research led me to research and led me to doing my PhD. And of course, I'm not going to say, the PhD experience was the best of the best, and I recommend it to everybody, because it's very, very, very difficult. It's quite long. It's quite a challenge. But I'm so pleased I did it. Now I can say that because it's about a year ago that I finished. During it, I might have had a very different answer. But I am super glad I did it, because it's opened more doors. I love clinical work. I love working with patients. That's my favorite thing to do, is be an audiologist. But when you can also do research, when you can also teach, it just gives you that wider perspective, and it really opens your eyes into healthcare sciences beyond audiology, and thinking of, obviously, what we want to do is think of our patients and members of the public as beyond ears, thinking about the whole person and healthcare more generally, and now seeing the importance of research and trying to lobby for more audiologists or healthcare professionals generally to do research as well, and try and fit it into the role more in a more formalized way. I know that was like a long answer, but there's those significant points in my journey so far.
I think one of the nice things for us to know would be sort of what inspired you to do your MSc after your BSc? What was the sort of turning points and the things that said, yes, I'm going to go ahead and do that?
That is a good question. When I did my BSc, I was really lucky that I got a job pretty much straight away in the department, NHS department that I did my placement in. And I was doing sort of a band 5 routine adult audiology role, which was really good. But what I found was that as I gained more experience, I was given the opportunity to be part of seeing pediatric clinics and helping out in pediatrics. And although we did learn about pediatrics in the BSc, you know, the purpose of that course is not to create a pediatric audiologist, it's to give you overall insights. But when I was in that role, in that band 5 role, and I was able to see more pediatric clinics and start helping out in pediatric clinics, I definitely saw the need to want to learn more, specifically for peds. So pediatric assessment, pediatric rehabilitation side of things. And so I could have, I suppose, done some individual modules to cover those things. But actually, I felt like having that part-time learning, completing a master's over time, because that's what I did. I carried on working, otherwise there's no way I would have afforded it. So I carried on working, and I did the MSc option, which you could do over 5 years, but I actually managed to complete it over 2 years. And that in that way, you can choose modules as you go along, so you're not kind of fixed into you have to do 5 modules this year. But luckily, I managed to take on more. But I think it's definitely into that. I wanted to specialise. I wanted to go into paediatrics. I didn't feel like I had the full skill set to do that, again, because the BSc wasn't designed for that. The department were really supportive that I worked in. And I think that's really important, having a really supportive department and colleagues that can see the real benefit of having that additional skill set and learning. But also, it took a bit off the department, right? That I could go somewhere else and learn the theory. It's not like the department needs to teach me all of that. But the practical side of things, I think that was important to do part-time. So I could have the clinical time to integrate the skills I was learning through my master's, rather than just doing a full-time master's and not being able to implement anything I was learning. So that model really worked well for me. But it was all because I wanted to go into pediatrics.
Oh, fantastic. And then would you say that sort of your experiences in Zambia and them asking about, you know, where's the research, would you say that that is what inspired you to do your PhD, or do you have a different story as to what inspired you to move on to your PhD?
I think I was lucky that I had a really good MSc research project supervisor, and I got quite a lot of freedom to explore ideas within my research project. So sometimes you can do a research project as part of a degree, you know, you're doing your MSc and you're doing this research project, you can't quite see how it connects to your clinical life or what change this can bring for patients that you would see in the clinic. And actually, my supervisors, both of them, were really keen to translate some of the work I was doing into something that can be really useful, clinical tool. But of course, there's only a certain amount of research you can do in your MSc, because it's you're just limited by time. So I could feel myself really getting into it. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, I have to stop now because I need to write up and I need to submit it on time. And it's really short. It's just a small glimpse into what research could be. But I think that positive experience and having really, really supportive supervisors who did say to me at the end, you know, if you did want to take this forward as a PhD, have that discussion with us. And at that time I was like, no, I'm not good enough for a PhD, I could never do that, it's too difficult, I'm an audiologist, audiologists don't do PhDs, I don't need a PhD to be an audiologist. So it was a hard no at that time. And Zambia opened that door again to make me consider it, because everybody was going on about research.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it was both of those things in combination.
Wow. So, of course, with everything that you've experienced in your audiology career, and you spoke about the challenges that you faced as well, do you have any advice to anybody sort of in terms of how to overcome challenges? Is there anything that you did in terms of self-care or you know, anything you sort of did to help with those challenges that you were facing?
Yeah, I think the ability, so it can be difficult to reach out if you're working alone and you're trying to think about what your options are. It's quite difficult to know what's out there unless you kind of put yourself out there. So the ability to reach out, and particularly, you know, audiology, it being a small field, even research in our area is fairly small. And I remember when I was in my first year of my PhD, I had no clue what I was doing. I mean, to be honest, that feeling lasted into my second year and the third year as well, to be fair. But in my first year, I had no idea. And it was kind of like, it was okay. Like, at some point, you have to realize it's okay to feel like that. It's okay to feel like you don't belong, because it's a different, it's totally different. You're really learning again. For a qualified clinician, you've built skills, you're confident in your clinical life. For you to then be into the deep end again, to not have a clue, it's very, very difficult. But being open to talk about how difficult it is, because other people have gone through that and have some really useful tips, I think is really important. So I would say, reach out to other people, look for mentorship, and it could be formalized mentorship. It could just be somebody who's doing something that you're interested in. Drop them an email to say whatever your specific question is, if they would also consider mentoring you. Within our field, you know, there's we've got BAA, BSA, there's different things going on with both organizations to support people who are early on in their career. And I'm glad activities are happening right now to provide that support a bit more. But definitely for me, resourcefulness, finding out that you're not going to be the expert in everything, and that's okay, because other people are experts in those specific things and they can help you, and it's often quicker than you really struggling for weeks and pulling your hair out about it. Just ask the question to say, either can you help me, or could you signpost me to somewhere? I've got this really specific question and I could do with some help. Resourcefulness and resilience to get through, because it definitely, those challenges can be quite difficult. And with self-care, I mean, to be honest, I would love to say I really looked after myself. Now I can reflect back on what I did, I suppose, in the last 10 years, and definitely say I wish I took care of myself more, but I am learning to. I think everybody's on their own journey with self-care and taking a break without the guilt of doing, you know, feeling like you need to be doing something else. But to know that you can't really apply your 100% if there isn't 100% of you, because you haven't taken care of yourself. So I'm working on that one.
I wish this podcast was recorded before I did my STP so I could take on this advice.
It's hard. It's really hard. You want to just complete what you need to complete, and then you say, I'll look after myself afterwards. But ultimately, the quality of the work that you're doing is not going to be of the standard you want it to be, because you didn't look after yourself in the first place.
Yeah. And how would you describe sort of the whole work-life balance side of things when you went through your MSc, even BSc and your PhD, of course?
Yeah, interesting. I think a lot of people do say to me that I mustn't have a good work-life balance because I'm doing lots of stuff. But actually, I think I do. Like, I think that it's hard for someone to see the tasks. Like, if I was to say, oh, here's my CV, and you just look at that and you're like, oh, you can't have a work-life balance if you do all of this. Actually, I think it's about how you balance everything. You know, if you work better at 7 o'clock, if you can, and you have the flexibility to work better if you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, or you work better at 7 till 8 p.m. in the evening, that is totally fine. You know, you're working around the life that you have, and you're putting in your hours for your job that you're, you know, employed to do, and then your additional tasks you try and fit around stuff. If you are super passionate about the work, if you are trying to balance research, teaching and clinical, it's hard. In our field, we do have there are a lack of I suppose jobs that would fully encompass all of the three things that I've mentioned. So for me, I have to kind of piece together, my working week from different, I've got different employers, right? I'm part-time this, part-time that, a third that, a third that, a third that, whatever. And that's my employment. But on top of that, taking on positions like me being a trustee of the BSA, or, you know, I do the book review editing for ENT and Audiology News magazine. Obviously, that's all voluntary. And we have to acknowledge that it's really hard, that if you really want to put your soul into the voluntary stuff, that time has to come from somewhere. But it's about balance, and it's about taking on what you can manage, and learning to say no. And this is where some people who know me well probably think I don't do that very well. But I have actually learned recently to say no. I can't fit that in. I do not have capacity. I'm at my limit. I can't take on new stuff. And I think that's only been probably since I finished my PhD, and then I got back, tried to get back into my normal, whatever, life. And at that point, I was quite burnt out, and I couldn't physically take on new tasks. So that has lasted me now, and I hope it lasts forever more, the ability to say no to stuff. And I think, particularly given that this is about early careers, I think early career professionals really want to prove themselves a lot and want to take on loads and loads of stuff. But ultimately, you have to look at it. If you write a list, I mean, if you've got like 10 things on that list, I'm sure you could cross off 5 and nobody would ever notice. Or you could say, I've done a presentation at a conference. You don't have to take the lead on organizing the entire conference. You've done a presentation at it. So you have to see what's going to give the most, I don't know, strength to your CV, or what tasks are the most meaningful to you, what gives you the skills. And it's give and take. If you're giving a lot, but you're not gaining anything, or you feel like you're not learning anything from it, it's also one of those things where you could probably let it go and say no. Mm-hmm. But for sure, if you're early on in your career, you want to say yes to everything.
I think you make a very strong point about learning to say no, definitely, because you have that guilt when you're studying about burnout. Well, you have that guilt that when you're not working and you're burning yourself out, it's quite, you know, oh, I'm not doing work at this moment, but you can't physically do it because you're experiencing burnout. But then you feel guilty that you're not doing it, and you keep saying yes to everything. So I think that's a very valuable point about learning to say no at the right times, definitely that.
And visualizing, what will that piece of work look like if I say yes, being burnt out? Are you going to be happy with giving, you know, doing that piece of work, submitting it to whatever you're doing, and it not being your standard? And then I think if you sat with that for a while, that would help you say no.
Yeah. And would you describe yourself as a very sort of, when it comes to planning ahead, would you say that you would describe yourself as very punctual when it comes to planning your workout and like schedules, etc.? Do you have any advice around that side of things?
I don't think I am good at that. I don't think I'm good at that. I did spend a long time procrastinating on the best way to organize myself. Like I think I invested so much time in comparing apps, buying different diaries, and you end up wasting a lot of time doing that. And then you realize you haven't actually done anything. So I think if you just have one set, I mean, I swear by just a Google Calendar, put your tasks in. If I have a meeting that is not an Outlook invitation, sorry, I'm not going to be able to come because it doesn't exist. Like it has to, I'm a very visual person, it has to be just there. And main tasks and milestone things, then yeah, I plan towards those. Yeah, I haven't been, and again, maybe because I was and I had to be so, I guess, good at planning during my PhD to get it done. Afterwards, I just sort of like, I'm trying to be a bit more free, still completing the tasks, but not let it overwhelm me. And not sort of, if I lay in bed at night, I shouldn't be able to see sort of Excel spreadsheets in my in my mind. I should just be able to sleep.
Yes. Okay, so in terms of sort of individuals or experiences that you've found have impacted you or your professional development or inspired you along the way, who would you name, or what experiences would you mention?
Who would I? I think I have been very lucky that I've been like really inspired by the women who have balanced so many things to get to the levels that they're at. So again, going back to like my PhD supervisors, both female, both juggling a hell of a lot of things. They both have children, you know, family commitments, all sorts of different things. And yet they're leading labs in world leading institutions for research. still with, you know, really, really, they're getting, you know, research grants, they're publishing papers, they're at the top of their game, and they're still doing it with all sorts of things going on in their lives. And I think also learning from patients that we see, I think that's probably one of the things that really guided me through my PhD. I did my PhD through COVID, and it evolved in a way that I didn't think it would, because it had to. The data collection mechanisms that I had just weren't going to work within a pandemic. And so I ended up doing quite a lot of qualitative work, lots of online stuff. But when participants could come in to do my kind of clinical, like, testing and getting my data collected, the stories that they told me, so these are people, you know, with deafness, hearing loss, they would come in and they would talk about, oh, I've never taken part in research, I've never done a speech test, this is really interesting. But these are long-term hearing aid users, and they would tell me all sorts about their experience within audiology. And so that led me to wanting to capture more of what they were saying, and led me to doing more qualitative work. And I think one of my favorite things to do now is to talk with them even more in a more formalized way, doing lots of patient and public involvement activities, even my research, to get their experiences. I could have a really, really, like, I could be so set in my ways with a really nice research design, say, I'm going to do that, that sounds really good. But then you bring some people together who have that lived experience of hearing difficulties, deafness, and they say, well, you know, that's not of importance to us. That's not, that won't work because of X, Y, and Z. Creating accessible tools for people with deafness and hearing loss, super important. I was doing online research, doing interviews with people that struggled with communication, because at that time we weren't so savvy with planning things for people, you know, with different hearing losses, different types of deafness. So I spent a lot of work making sure that my research was accessible and that anybody could sign up. But we still know that there are a hell of a lot of people that don't sign up to research because we're not reaching them. So I think if there's anybody doing work that tries to bring all sorts of different people, all sorts from different backgrounds, you know, different abilities, everything like that, because it's very valuable and it gives us a richer picture of what we're writing about. Otherwise we're just writing about all of the same people all of the time. So that would be it. My supervisors, anyone who's mentored me, I've always asked for mentorship, I've always asked for help, and those people have been very valuable. And committees that I've been in, if you've got a supportive network of your other committee members, really important. But I think most importantly, the patients and members of the public that have influenced my projects along the way and continue to do so.
That's actually really good. I feel as well that everything that we do in terms of research and in terms of the clinical work is all for our patients. And it follows in quite nicely to my next question. So as an aspiring figure in the audiology field, what role do you believe audiologists play in improving the quality of life for individuals with hearing impairment?
We play a big role in awareness raising. There are a lot of people that still don't know what the field of audiology is. Sort of ear health, hearing screening, what the kind of point is of all of that. So awareness raising is something that's really important. To also see the full range of the community that we will be seeing in the clinic. And I think we have a huge role in to try and make health services beyond audiology much more accessible to those who are deaf or have hearing loss. Because at the moment, the communication barrier that exists across the NHS and probably private sector, but I haven't looked into that, that communication barrier is big, and it will affect how health services are used, the effectiveness and people's perceptions of health services, their trust in health professionals, because simply they can't communicate. And if you can't communicate, well, you know, you could go to a consultation. I've never been in that situation, but I can only imagine what it could be like if you are sitting in that consultation, not hearing, or you're not being communicated with in an effective way. You'll leave that consultation very anxious and worried about what that was about. So I think audiologists play a really, really vital role, given that we see on a daily basis people with a variety of different communication methods. We should know what we could recommend. We should know the things that work well. And so we should try and be a bit more of a guiding light for that. But at the moment, we know that even in audiology clinics, it's not quite being done as well as it should be. So if we can get our house in order first and then potentially speak out and advocate for people who can't advocate for themselves, I think that's really important.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's rounded quite nicely, actually. The last question that I've got for you is, what advice would you give to the early professional members?
Talk to each other. Talk to other people at different levels. Most people are going to be far more open than you think. If you just have questions to ask, go to events as much as you can. Sign up to conferences you wouldn't otherwise normally sign up to. I think that's probably the number one thing that's helped me. As well as, of course, I'm going to say prioritize your self-care, even if I didn't do that, but I'm gonna say that because I'm finding it now really important. And, you know, I've had how many years? 11 years in clinical practice. But because I've just finished my PhD and I'm now postdoc, I'm early careers, right? I'm still early careers. So I don't know how long I can keep being early careers. I probably still will be in another 5 years because I'm early in my research career. And so you can learn these skills at any point. You don't need to try and learn everything at the beginning. You can see how you get on, try small tasks and be able to tick tasks off a list rather than take on huge chunks of work and think that this is what you're going to be able to pour all of your energy in, because you have a life outside of your work.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for everything. And thank you for answering all the questions today and being on the podcast with us. It was lovely to have a chat with you. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much.